Hello, and welcome to the October edition of In Conversation with the Lancet HIV's podcast. I'm Philippa Harris, the deputy editor, and today I'm talking to John Shooter from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine about cigarette smoking and harm reduction for people living with HIV. Before we get to this, I wanted to highlight some of our other October content, which includes the 2019 Global Burden of Disease Study, looking at the global, regional, and national sex-specific burden and control of the HIV epidemic. This issue also contains studies looking at preterm birth in pregnant women living with HIV and cancer risk among adolescents and young adults with HIV in South Africa. And now to speak to John.
Thank you, John, for speaking to us today. So we're talking about your viewpoint. So why should clinicians who provide care for people living with HIV be particularly aware of smoking cessation and harm reduction approaches for smoking?
Yes. So I'd like to start with the big picture, and that is that cigarette smoking has emerged as the leading killer in individuals living with HIV in the modern antiretroviral era. There are a fair amount of data supporting that view, both in the United States and Western Europe, and that's based on big picture statistics. But you know, not only do research, but I've been for decades a clinician who takes care of a fairly sizable panel of people living with HIV. So I like to start all of these sorts of talks about my research with stories that I think can make the issue more real. So we had an unfortunate story, a true story that we're living through right now. I have a patient. She's got well-controlled HIV, and she's been pretty healthy in most other ways. But she's been a cigarette smoker, and I'm something of an anti-smoking zealot, so I've been trying to get her to quit for the last 25 years unsuccessfully. And she started complaining about a cough to me several months ago. The diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer was confirmed. It's a terrible story, but it's an all-too-common story. And we talk a lot about statistics and curves and survival analyses and that sort of thing. And there's a danger in summarizing data in that way, that you could forget that that those data are the sum total of a whole lot of tragic life stories. And this is one of them. So I always keep that in the forefront of my mind. And that is why it is really, really important for us to do a better job with smoking cessation. And as we argue in this paper, that the approach to tobacco use and smoking cessation maybe should not be all or none, but should expand into the harm reduction realm. And I think we'll talk more about that as the podcast goes on. But the idea of harm reduction is that for people who can't quit, and that's probably 85 to 90% of smokers living with HIV, even those whom we try to get to quit very aggressively, still the vast majority continue to smoke. But maybe we can do some real benefit. Almost certainly we could create some real benefit by getting them to at least cut down and to do other things that I think that we'll talk about as the podcast goes on, to mitigate other end organ risks of cigarette smoking.
So yeah, you know, you highlight obviously that, you know, in an ideal world everyone would stop smoking, but why can that be particularly challenging for smokers living with HIV?
At least where I work, but I think this is representative for sure of the United States and Western Europe. But probably globally also, maybe with different nuances, that people living with HIV have an array of sociobehavioral factors that predispose them to smoke, to start smoking, to continue smoking, and to have a hard time quitting. Those sociobehavioral factors are driven by higher rates of psychiatric comorbidities and substance use. So it is really hard to quit smoking if you are depressed and you don't even really want to go on living. So the message that you should quit smoking so you could live longer might not resonate very well. Or if you have a severe anxiety disorder and you depend on cigarettes to calm you down and get you through the day, or if you're a user of other substances where cigarette smoking is really tied in with that whole substance use culture, it can be hard to untangle it from other substance uses. And it can be very challenging to quit everything altogether. But I do want to move on to a second point here. And that is a really, really important point that we've discovered both in our qualitative and our quantitative research. And I'm going to state something that I think is obvious, but maybe is not thought about enough, that people with HIV are not a homogeneous group. And different subgroups of them have different challenges pertaining to their tobacco use. So, for example, people who use cocaine and heroin and are tobacco users, it is part of the drug-using lifestyle and culture. Your friends that also use substances are probably also have very high rates of tobacco use, and there's a thought that tobacco use might sustain or prolong the high associated with these drugs. So those different behaviors are very much entangled. So that is cocaine and heroin users. Methadone maintenance patients, right? Work around the corner from methadone maintenance program, and you see the people going in every day, lined up outside, many of them smoking. Obviously, you can't smoke inside in these centers, at least in the United States. But in order to get there, you have to walk through a tobacco smoke cloud. And it is hard to quit if you're exposing yourself to that every day. Now, that is different from the MSM group that we study. Tobacco use in MSM tends to be a very, very social phenomenon. So you could wind up being an outsider in a group of MSM who are smoking, and you are the one who is not smoking. It's a hard stance to take if you want to be part of certain social groups, and that's something that we've discovered in that subset of the population. We've had transgenders tell us it is really hard to quit smoking because the hormones that I take make me moody, and smoking is the only thing that controls that well. And finally, the patients and the individuals with psychiatric comorbidities, I've already alluded to this. It can be very hard to quit smoking if you're in the midst of a severe depression or anxiety, or patients with psychosis who smoke at very, very high rates. And the smoking could be a sort of self-medication of their psychiatric morbidity. All of those are distinct factors that make it really hard to quit. But they are more prevalent in different subsets. And I think for any given patient that you're trying to get to quit, you have to explore those things and see why they're smoking and what their social groups are and that sort of thing.
And so what sort of evidence-based approaches do we know can work for smoking cessation? And what is the evidence base for their effectiveness in smokers living with HIV?
So regrettably, not too much has worked very well, at least in clinical trials, to promote smoking cessation in this group. You know, I think that the people who listen to this podcast will be familiar to some extent with the reality that there's a mountain of evidence for the general population of smokers on what works. And what works in them, what works best, is a combination of behavioral therapy in the form of counseling, all different kinds of counseling, live counseling, one-on-one counseling, group counseling, web-based counseling, text-based message counseling. All of these things are evidence-based in the general population, and they work best when you combine them with one of the approved pharmacotherapies. When you put those two things together, you can achieve reasonable quit rates. Now, you get used to failure in this business. So people who are involved in tobacco treatment for a career, you know, if they can get 25 or 30% of their candidates to quit smoking, they are rock stars. So under the best of circumstances, we have to accept failure in most cases. But the most effective approaches combine aggressive and intensive behavioral therapy and intensive pharmacotherapy combined. There's a small evidence base for combined behavioral and pharmacotherapy in people with HIV, and just a handful of studies, really three studies so far, that combined those two modalities in different ways and yielded quit rates that were significantly better than control at the 6-month mark. more of the therapies were able to achieve 3-month quits, but had high relapse rates at 6 months. And the value of getting someone to quit for a short window of time just to relapse down the road I don't know what the long-term benefit of that is. And it just another word or two about things that work. We have a suggestion from our data that there is a role for peer support and social support. So when we involve ex-smokers with HIV in the conversation and the counseling, that seems to promote higher rates of quitting. We have found that an approach that builds and fortifies self-efficacy, so that is a psychological term that refers to one's estimation of one's ability to avoid the temptation to smoke in various circumstances. So we ask questions, how tempted would you be to smoke in a bar with friends? And after you become depressed over a specific depressing situation, et cetera, with the triggers for smoking, and ask them how tempted they would be, and then tailor our counseling message based on that. So maybe anticipate that since the bar is going to be a really tempting place for you to light up, maybe you should stay away from the bar for the first few months that you've quit. Avoid those high-risk situations. And finally, when we ask individuals to rate their satisfaction with the messages they've received, they tend to rate high the elements of the intervention that are tailored to them. So, I mean, that's a theme in much of the tobacco treatment literature, that when you tailor the message to the target group, that message resonates better with them.
So your viewpoint talks about a sort of looking at a more holistic view of harm reduction for smokers. And I wondered if you could expand on that and kind of the key points that you think are worth highlighting.
Yes, I would really like to get away from the very restrictive view of harm reduction that emerged from the original description of harm reduction, where the term was coined in the early 1980s, where we were trying to reduce harm by reducing substance use and sexual risk behaviors. There was a theme in a lot of that literature and the harm reduction approach that you might not be able to extinguish those behaviors, but if you could reduce those behaviors, there would be a mathematical, resultant reduction in the amount of HIV transmission in the community. So that's where harm reduction comes from. But the restrictive view is harm reduction is about cutting down in someone who can't quit. And there probably is value in that in cigarette smokers. There's not tons of data about the downstream beneficial effects of, say, cutting from a pack a day to half a pack a day. I think that it is sensible to believe that it is better to smoke half a pack a day than a full pack a day. And there's an awful lot of evidence that lighter smokers, long run lighter smokers, do better from the standpoint of lung cancer and cardiovascular risk than heavier smokers. So that view is not a matter of debate. That is proven. But the actual effects of getting someone to cut from a pack a day to half a pack a day, It's probably a good thing to do, and I think most people would accept that. But there's less evidence that you wind up with health benefits by doing that. We do and support the idea of cutting down. Another reason to support cutting down is that oftentimes reducing your daily cigarette smoking winds up being a stepping stone on the way to quitting for good. So that is the reduce to quit approach, and there is a literature supporting that. But your question was about a more expansive, holistic approach to cigarette smoking and to tobacco treatment. So I'm a strong supporter of the idea that we should try to, think logically about this. Why is smoking bad? Smoking bad because it has downstream bad health effects that lead to morbidity and mortality. So what kills smokers? It's the same question for what kills smokers who are living with HIV. So the things that kill them are lung cancer and cardiovascular disease, so myocardial infarction and strokes and progressive lung disease. So there are measures that are out there and very well proven in the general population that can mitigate those risks. And in the paper, we argue for more aggressive screening for lung cancer. So there is a robust evidence base to support low-dose CT scan screening for lung cancer, and we should be doing more of that in our population. In more aggressive lipid and blood pressure control, hyperlipidemia and hypertension are much more prevalent in people with HIV, and we could do a much better job of controlling those things. So even if someone continues to smoke, we can lower the lipids and we can lower the blood pressure and hopefully result in a lesser rate of heart attacks and strokes and those and mortality related to those things. And those are things that are pretty easily done in the clinical setting. And for people who are too busy to do that, appropriate referrals could be made to other subspecialists to try to be more aggressive, particularly about lipid and blood pressure control.
So you're based in the States, and obviously a lot of the published data comes from that, either the States or sort of North America in general. But, you know, how global do you think this approach should be?
So that's a great question. So I think that there's enough evidence to convince us that the United States and Western Europe are similar with regard to most of these issues. But it would be a tremendous leap to say that the same issues apply and pertain in Africa or in Asia or in other areas of the world. We do some tobacco work in my group in Kenya, and we've done some qualitative research in that area. I'm also involved in some work that's being done in Vietnam. And when you interview individuals with HIV who also smoke and try to understand their beliefs and practices regarding their cigarette smoking, there are differences. I think that it's universal that people understand that smoking does bad things to one's health. But the actual social circumstances that surround the cigarette smoking behaviors in these different areas of the world are very different. So in Kenya, where we have a trial going on, for example, there are a lot lower rates of people scoring in depressed and anxious ranges in depression anxiety scales. So that might be less of an issue there. In Vietnam, where smoking is restricted almost exclusively to men, there's a lot of disapproval among their wives at home. And that's not something that we've really discovered in our qualitative research in the United States, or at least in New York. So that might be something that one can leverage when one is trying to develop smoking cessation interventions for these populations. So I think that, you know, it's kind of an obvious statement, but it would be foolish to try to impose American or Western European values and beliefs on tobacco cessation initiatives in other areas of the world. And in order to do things right, one has to do qualitative and quantitative research in those areas to see what kind of message is the right message to deliver and what would resonate best with the target population.
So talking about research, so where do you think the main research gaps are? You know, what information could we have that could really help smokers living with HIV? And is there anything in particular you'd like to see change? You know, if only one or two things could change in clinical practice, what should those things be?
Well, I think that there's a desperate need for a better evidence base for what works, because so few things have been proven to work. And you know, the world of clinical providers who take care of these patients directly, that is a group of individuals who rely on evidence-based medicine. They don't like to do stuff that doesn't work, and understandably so. And frankly, they don't have time to do that sort of thing. You know, as someone who goes to clinic several times a week and sees many of these patients, I understand how challenging it can be and how complicated the patients are. So I think a real need is not only to find something that works so that we can offer it to the people, but try to structure the clinical visit in a way that fosters this and might, you know, potentially promote success. Because, you know, in real world terms, what happens with so many of these patients, including my own, is that you go into the visit, you have, say, a 20-minute block of time to complete that visit and all the paperwork that goes along with it. And the patient is in an HIV clinic, so your first question all the time is, are you taking your medicine? You have to delve into adherence. You have to go over T cell counts and viral loads. And then there's generally a multiplicity of other problems that have to be addressed. So, you know, problem one is HIV. And then there's asthma, and then there's hypertension, and then there's cardiac, and then there's the social situation. And, you know, I'm getting evicted from my apartment, and I can't pay my rent. And these are all real problems that have to be addressed by the, or at least understood and acknowledged by the doctor and the rest of the providers in clinic. And smoking is one of those things on the list. And you only have a few seconds to deal with each of them. So oftentimes, the smoking cessation item on that problem list is noted. And, you know, at most, the plan is encourage smoking cessation. And I don't even know how you do that, but encourage smoking cessation and return to clinic in 2 or 3 months. I think that that's a bad and an unsuccessful approach. So I pushed to try to actually have individual visits where I warn the patient that next time you come in, we are going to focus only on cigarette smoking. Or it might not only be that. It might be next time you come in, we're going to focus only on your diabetes, or we're going to focus only on your asthma. And that kind of approach, I think, can sometimes be more productive, because then you could get a 20-minute block of time to actually talk to that person about the cigarette smoking and try to increase their motivation to quit and give them some strategies and teach them why pharmacotherapy would be a really useful adjunct to the treatment. And I think that sort of approach really can improve your odds of succeeding. I don't know if I'm running long or not, but just a couple of other little points. I think there's room for innovation and innovative research here. So the whole topic of genetic predictors of substance use and cessation is a very, very active field. So we need to understand more about genetic traits that lead one to smoke or to fail to quit, so that we have those markers, and you know, that might be off in the future, but there are groups that are actively researching that. And other more innovative approaches like contingency management, exploration of social network aspects of smoking, these are very, very important topics, and everyone knows they're important, but not enough research has been done. So those are our future research areas that could produce findings that manifest themselves in a productive way in the clinical setting eventually.
So everyone needs to get writing grants. That's the message. So
get this writing evidence. And hopefully some of the grants get funded and the research gets done. So yes, I'm all for that.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. And if you're interested in this topic, The Lancet HIV published a trial in the 2018 March issue on varenicline for smoking cessation in people living with HIV in France. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the podcast, and we'll be back next month to continue the conversation.